morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program in requiem for two great women who have recently died, Diane Keaton and Jane Goodall. Each in their own manner have advanced humanity's understanding a few more faltering steps. And not least on this date in 1966, a 75-year-old Texas man qualified as the worst auto driver in U.S. history. He received 10 traffic tickets, drove on the wrong side of the street 4 times, committed 4 hit-and-run offenses, and caused 6 accidents all within 20 minutes. And yesterday, on October 15, 1940, Charlie Chaplin's famous and profoundly funny, not to mention prophetic, movie, The Great Dictator, premiered in American theaters. And now, something I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, now defunct. 533 years ago, on Friday, October 12th, 1492, a Genoa seaman stumbled onto the Western Hemisphere while seeking passage to the Far East. One world was born that day, but the world that was here began that instant to die. Christopher Columbus missed his mark by half a world, and by that doubled the world's size. The old civilizations of Europe sent their most favored and dumped their least on the shores of the New World, though they were equals in their fervent obliteration of the worlds they found, and they turned on each other as well. 200 years later, the great thinkers of the 18th century debated the consequences of the European discovery of the American continents and concluded the costs had been too high for the gains. The great thinkers wished the great navigator had never set sail or had perished with his 3 small ships on the ocean, though someone would have claimed discovery of the New World eventually. And many had made landfalls in the same hemisphere from both Atlantic and Pacific Oceans hundreds, even thousands of years before. And Columbus might himself have wished he never sailed either. He died poor and in disgrace. Unknown at first to the Europeans who sought wealth with murder and torture of the primitive tribes they initially encountered, were great civilizations, as autocratic, expansive, and cruel as their own. A few matched and even exceeded the European cultures that were themselves just recovering from a prolonged regression. A renaissance of Western civilization, a rebirth of lost classical knowledge, culminated in the calamitous error of Columbus, who refused to believe that he had blundered upon an entirely unknown landmass that blocked his passage to the ancient East. And immediately he began the cruel harvest of native inhabitants that was to last for at least 4 centuries. As the natives perished by the millions from slaughter, forced labor, disease, and despair, half of Africa, it seemed, was emptied to provide slaves for New World plantations and mines, and millions died before ever reaching the Americas. New civilizations spawned upon the ruins of the obliterated, often deeply influenced by them, and one in particular emerged from seeds of radical ideas brought across the Atlantic from nations that spurned them into exile. This new culture was uncomfortably germinated by various peoples who had come to stay, some as seekers, others as slaves. and its government was founded on the heretical proposition that people should be free and equally rulers of the state. The ideal was always in conflict with reality. At times, the tension created brilliant advances in civil liberties. Most of the time, progress was slow, bloody, and often as not retrogressive. The major contradictions of the growing republic were its long acceptance of slavery and the remorseless extermination of native cultures and ethnic cleansing, repeated in other places in more recent times. The observance of Columbus's first voyage to the Americas, named after a later Italian explorer who was not fooled into believing he had reached Asia, is heated and controversial. Some celebrate, others bitterly denounce the intrusion of Europe upon the Western Hemisphere and half a millennium of conquest, epidemic, and cultural genocide. Words of placation or condemnation are exchanged. The old world invaded, encountered, conquered, converged with the new, depending on the perspective of the speakers. However one might feel, Columbus and his successors are as inescapable a fact of history as the great meteor that crashed where Iceland is now and which ended the long-ago age of the dinosaurs. Columbus's voyage began the end of a long age of seclusion of descendants of Asian hunters who had crossed over in periods when the Bering Sea was shallow and the continents were connected at their northern extremities and were subsequently cut off from the rest of the human world when the waters rose again. The ancient cycles of pre-Columbian civilizations disappeared under the onslaught of invaders who were oblivious of them. In the same manner, sometime in the future, the civilizations that have grown from their ruins will be devoured, deteriorate, or self-destruct. And in the words of Lafcadio Hearn, who favored the resurgence of Asia over the West, post-Columbian cultures, quote, will be as mist as the ichthyosaur, unquote. And that was something I wrote for my defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, and I wrote it in October 1992 on the quintessential observance of his first voyage to the New World. And now, something I wrote while learning American journalism as an aging copyboy at a Pasadena daily newspaper. Prior to that journalistic introduction, I had worked a few seasons for the U.S. Forest Service as a member of a so-called hotshot forest fire crew in the Angeles National Forest in the mountains above Los Angeles. We were the Dalton Hotshots, not named after the infamous Dalton brothers of old West Bank bandits, but after a canyon in the Angeles National Forest above Smogtown, USA. Hotshots fight fires with what one of us called hand tools. Our job was to cut hotline, to deny fire fuel with brush hooks, Pulaskis, and McLeods. We cut line ahead of a fire, often alongside a fire, in a rush to head it off, a fiercely hot and dangerous job attempting to deny fire its fuel, quite often alongside a fire, as I earlier mentioned, in a dangerous, sweaty race. Two heads had the serpent. The orange laughter of fire danced into the mountain sky and beneath its shrouds of rolling black smoke. Strangled and choked skeletons of trees and brush were ripped from life as others became pyres in the wind-whipped death orgy that spiraled with the deafening roar of the summer dry slopes. The wailing of a siren split the sky. From all over the fire station, men ran to the green stakeside truck and clambered onto the long benches in the rear as the engine came to life and the truck jumped forward, red lights flashing and sirens screaming. A trail of blinding dust followed them along the dirt path to the highway, and the sirens screamed louder to the cars suddenly pulling off the road. "There it is," a man pointed to the black-brown fist in the skies above the jagged horizon. "It's a big bastard," shouted another over the siren as the truck raced onto the swirling mountain road and through the roadblock already set up by the police. "Adams," somebody yelled, and a youth swiveled his head from the fascinated fear of the piles of smoke and glare of flame. "You're going to bust your cherry on this one." And he grinned with a bravado to the rejoinder of someone else. "You'll be an old whore." The truck ran up the mountain, and the fire came closer, and its thunder drowned all other noise. It was Adam's first fire, and he exulted in the urgent pulse of the siren. He felt the heat, and his head ached from the roar as he saw the impossible strength of this Goliath he was to risk his puny life against. He felt an excited fear tingle through his body. Fire trucks were parked all along the road when they rounded the last bend, and the road was crisscrossed with white snakes of hose. Crews of men ran and shouted and disappeared into the acrid blanket of smoke. The truck lurched to a stop, and the crew jumped to the ground as the benches became the open lids to chests of tools. The men filed along the sides as two others handed down their weapons. The slender, lethal brush hooks, the half-axe, half-pick Pulaskis, the rake-like McLeods, the curved gooseneck shovels, and they formed into a single line to follow their foreman up the brush-cluttered and burning hill. "We got to get it before it gets to the back country," a small man gasped to the foreman. Adams knew him as the district ranger. "If the fire gets back there, there's no stopping it." The foreman nodded and started up into the wind-tattered smoke. Scrambling over ledges, crashing through brush, the firefighters struggled to echo the long-legged, punishing gait of their mountain goat foreman. Adams felt his legs become heavy drums as he all but ran up the slope, clutching for hand and footholds, his fear forgotten in the pain of his laboring body. Why had he joined a hotshot crew, the infantry of the Forest Service? Why couldn't he have joined a tanker crew and rode around every fire on a truck? All that he wanted, all that his lungs and his heart cried for, was this climb to end. They finally reached the ridgeline. A dozen times Adams had seen chunks of skyline that his being prayed was a crest and wanted to collapse and quit each time he found that it was still ahead, jabbing far away into the sky. The first blast of the searing heat nearly felled him. His body felt a fire when he needed it most to cool off after the climb. His sweat-rimmed eyes saw the two-headed serpent hungrily reaching up the ridge just opposite. One head of the fire climbed, and the other wandered lost in the gully between the two ridges. The foreman took them down into the burning gully, and they ran through an area already burned, the heat sucking their lungs dry of breath, and they gambled against this segment of fire following them up the slope. Adams turned his worried head for a look behind and saw Cruz pounce into the gully and beat back the inferno and chop one of the heads from the serpent. "Start cutting here," the foreman shouted, halfway up the slope as the remaining head burned along the mountaintop to crawl down the other side. "We're going to catch her from the flanks and chase her down." The lead brush hook chopped into the brush and left a trail that was widened 5 yards behind him by the second hook man and widened yet further by another. So on down the line of sweating men with cutting tools. Then came the scrapers, scraping the grass and small brush to the mineral earth that fire cannot burn. Adams was a shovel man, and he was glad he wasn't stuck with a McLeod, as he saw the scrapers work like mad dogs to keep up with the cutters. He could see the lead hook some 100 yards ahead and above him on the newly created fire line. He could see the flashes of sharp steel in the sun. A rabbit of fire dashed across the line, spewing flames into the unburned brush with the last of its panicked life. Adams chased it down and killed it with the shovel, then swiftly smashed at the flames. A spot fire started somewhere else down along the line, and he scrambled to it, sweating and suddenly bone-weary. He hacked at branches and threw dirt, and finally the threat died. He wanted to sit and have a smoke. He wanted to empty his canteen down his dry throat. Another spark from the burned area jumped the line, and he ran after it. The fire slowed on the downhill plunge, and the crew began to catch up with it, stubbornly following up the flanks, hacking a swath of soil between charred, smoking ground and singed, but yet unburned watershed of chaparral. They worked past the small dancing snarls that still flamed many bushes and trees forgotten in the first rush of fire, and Adams and two others dug trenches to catch falling hot stuff that could cremate the other side of the line. Adams watched the last head of the serpent blunder down the reverse slope, its heat fleeing uselessly into the sky. He thought of it as an old man of evil, as it strained with its strength momentarily sapped against each bush to set it fully ablaze, and he knew the crew had to catch it before it reached the bottom and again became young and strong with its searing fury rising ahead to preheat the brush for the flames to swiftly ignite. They lost the round, and the fire crackled up in mockery for the opposite crest, and the crew lost heart and slowed in weary hopelessness. The foreman swore at them and kicked at them, pushing them on, and the man began to chant, "Kill it! Kill it! Kill it!" The voice was hoarse and breathless, and Adams heard. His blood pounded to the tempo. The desire to destroy this monster pierced his shuffling body. "Let's go, let's go," he found his voice in the sky, and others began to fill it with the lust that suddenly broke out into song. They were singing, all of them. They had found hope with primitive reason, and they worked to the rhythm of a filthy lyric that creased smiles on dirt and sweat-crusted faces. Adams felt something created here, something singular, with a single physical purpose, as the tempo pounded louder and faster. A thrilling spasm jumped along his spine. He felt sexually stimulated and excited with hate. This was spiritual combat, puny men against a terrifyingly inhuman evil that destroyed all good. It was the cry of youth for blood. It was his body and encased soul that demanded either the death of the fire or the man himself, and his brain sung the death song. They pushed their bodies harder than ever before, and the roar of the fire came closer. Hotline, they called it, and it was. The heat made men vomit blood and scorched their faces, and still they raced to the challenge. Closer and closer they came to the triangled head. The charred flanks were steadily extinguished. From the other side came another crew, and it was an exultant wild race to the furious spearhead of flame, two gangs of dirty and tired men becoming machines of competition and pride and lust. The fire was along the crest, and they neared it. Then the wind spilled it over the top and broke it into 100 small fires. A hoarse shout rose from parched throats, and the executioners pounced upon the serpent before it could regather its heads. The two crews spread along the downhill slope, every man for himself, killing fire and mindless hate. Discipline was forgotten. Danger was buried. Adams and another man attacked a burning cluster of scrub oak and chopped away at it. The shovel rose and fell in frenzy, scattering and extinguishing fire. A searing tongue licked his clothes and caught them afire. Instinctively, he fell and rolled in the ashes to smother it, and again was on his feet, swinging his shovel as if it were an axe. Suddenly, it was over, and everything stilled. The wind flattened. Men looked sheepishly at each other as the fury drained from their bodies. They stood along the slashed black corpse that now only trailed wisps of smoke into the silent sky. Adam's foreman came to his senses and ordered his crew to cold trail around the hill and surround it with a safety line, the burned from the unburned, and to trench it against falling burned debris. The foreman of the other crew took his men along the far side and began to cut towards a middle ground where the two crews would meet and sit down and have a smoke. The mountain was a black ghost smelling of char and death. Tattered wisps of smoke ventured from a thousand places, from still burning roots and trunks and branches. The bodies of deer and rabbits lay about the hillside, along with the more numerous rodents, most of them charred beyond recognition. Into this lifeless place, a string of men fanned out into a skirmish line and began the long, weary climb. One by one, from the sun's zenith to its red death, the thousand little smoking hot spots were extinguished. The bone-tired men topped the crest and turned around to work back down, and again to the top and back, hitting those fires that were missed, scrupulously exterminating the enemy. With the sky velvet and Venus soft in the east sky, with the first echoes of the night wind against the slope, they settled down for an all-night security watch. They dragged wood to a fire just kindled for warmth and set about it, tired and hungry, and some slept while others stayed awake and talked. Adams listened quietly to the oaths and grunts and tales of comparison the old hands told of fires they had fought in the past. He lay against the hard rocky ground, and just before sleep took him away for a while, his eyes looked into the cold stars that carpeted the black heavens. He remembered his thoughts of the morning when they had first climbed that hill into battle. Now, tired as he was glad he was a member of a hotshot crew, the infantry. He felt a pride in himself and the hard war just won. And his mind turned to the someday when this mountain would again be green and noisy with life. It would take time, and there was a season of rains ahead that would wash the loose soil and rocks into the valley and possibly swell the stream that wound through these mountains, and he would sandbag canyons against flood. He thought of himself as would a shepherd towards his sheep. He was a protector of the land. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. I almost got through this program without a mention of our neo-Nazi Nero president, who is the embodiment of just about every disgusting aspect of nasty governance that most certainly would disgust and appall our revolutionary ancestors. If indeed the U.S. of America, with a K, wants a despot as president, then at least it should prescribe a real deal Caesar Napoleon, not a dime store Hitler or lily-livered war shirker, such as failed Nobel Peace Prize seeker as Donald Trump, if anyone remembers his tawdry bug out of the Vietnam War, not from conscientious dissent, but rather from literally doctored medical records that have given him the nickname of Bone Spurs. a true heel. Pardon the cliche.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.